Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. Yeah, folks, you have no idea what you're missing. Well, maybe you do by now because you listen every week and I say the same thing over and over again. There is 2 times more show, actually 3 times more show. I'm bad at math, but better at politics. 3 times more show available to you over at ROFpodcast.com. Sign up for a membership. It's only a couple of quarters a day. And you will get 3 times more show. You'll get it commercial free. And you'll have access to over 10 years of our archives. And you'll keep this show chugging along. That's ROFpodcast.com. Head over now. Thanks so much for listening. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, Daniel Denver will join us to discuss his new book, All American Nativism, which describes American history through the lens of immigration politics. Progressive congressional candidate Ondam Ghebreyesus will join us to discuss his race in New York's 16th district against longtime incumbent and chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Elliot Engel. Heather Digby Parton will be here to run down all the big news stories from the past week. And John Nichols from The Nation magazine will join us from Iowa to give us the scoop of what's happening on the ground ahead of Monday's caucus. Hey, are you listening on one of our radio affiliates right now? Well, you should know there's a free 1 hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever your podcasts are found. There's also a member show, and you can support Ring of Fire by becoming a member and getting our 3 hour radio program commercial free. With access to years and years of our archives, you can go to ROFpodcast.com to sign up. Help me run down the most important news stories of this week. Heather Digby Parton from Salong. So, Heather, the impeachment story gets more complicated this week. Of course, we've got a lot to talk about. Impeachment. We are now just a couple of days away from the Iowa caucuses. We will talk about that later, but I mean, it is, there's always a lot riding on Iowa, either way. I don't know if this year feels more dramatic just because there's a sense of the stakes being more dramatic in terms of not just who's going to be the Democratic nominee, but we have an alarming president in office. I think the last time that we were thinking about the caucus, really the last 2 times we were thinking about the Iowa caucus in terms of Democrats, there was no incumbent president. And so it didn't have the exactly the same stakes, and the incumbent president wasn't Donald Trump. But we will get to that. Speaking of Donald Trump, he has been impeached and there's been a trial that's going on in the Senate. And the week started off with the Republican, or I should say, the Republicans and the president offering a defense of the president. His lawyers had, over the weekend into Monday, to make their opening statements of their defense. I mean, this is all sort of backwards, but that's in some ways by design, by Mitch McConnell's design. And in the midst of their defense, a huge bombshell drops, which is that someone had leaked information about a manuscript or a draft, still unclear, of John Bolton's forthcoming book. It's set to be released on March, I think it's 13th is the publication date, or was, or is, I don't know yet. And saying that Donald Trump had explicitly said, this is a quid pro quo. I don't know if you use those words, but Ukraine is not getting the money until they investigate or say they're going to investigate the Bidens. And then the calculus shifted. Where are we now by the end of this week? There's there's been a whole set of machinations. Mitch McConnell has said that he doesn't think he has the votes. We have different arguments shifting a little bit with the president, saying, well, even if what Bolton says was true, that doesn't matter. The president can do whatever he wants, essentially. Where are we with this?
Well, I mean, just the way you laid it out there shows how complicated this thing has become, largely because of it. Now, Bolton, you and I have been talking about Bolton's testimony for weeks. I mean, ever since we first heard that he was writing a book, and then more recently when he indicated that he was willing to testify before the Senate if they subpoenaed him. And we've been wondering, and I think we said just a week ago, you know, I was sort of saying, hey, I don't really trust Bolton as far as I can throw him. And you said, well, I don't know, it doesn't make sense that he would do this if he didn't have something, you know, meaningful to say in this whole thing. And you were right, because if the book manuscript as it's been described in the New York Times is correct, he definitely backs up everything his lieutenants, you know, people like Fiona Hill and Alexander Vindman and all of those, were said in their testimony in the House. And he actually takes it into the Oval Office with the president and says the president told him that after the Zelensky call, that he was actually saying that in August. And that's a big, important piece of evidence that, you know, we've been sort of waiting, hoping that someone would say. And it would, just to back up a little bit, I think what's interesting about the way this unfolded is interesting in itself, because what we've also found out, aside from the book, you know, what it says in the New York Times, or at least certain excerpts of it, is the fact that the White House has had that book since December 30th. The publisher and his agent, I think Bolton's agent, gave it to the White House to look over. And interestingly, Bolton had a very unusual agreement with the White House that they would have 30 days to look at it. And if they didn't, you know, and unless they found something classified in it, they, you know, would go ahead and release it. Now, you know, I think that, you know, the lawyers, Trump's lawyers, and I think Trump himself, if I'm not mistaken, came out and said, oh, we didn't know anything about this book. You know, yeah, it's been here since December 30th, but we never saw it. We didn't read it. That's utter nonsense. They are obviously lying. And one of the ways we know this is because when Trump was in Davos just last week, what he said was that, you know, when they asked him, well, you want John to, you know, you want Bolton to testify, he said, well, it's a national security problem. You know, he knows some of my thoughts, what I think about leaders. And if it's something not positive, that caused me a problem. So it's going to be very hard. It's a national security issue. Well, my personal opinion is that that is what set, you know, alarm bells off in John Bolton, realizing that they were going to try and stop his book. And I think that's why it leaked when it did, and because I think he knew that they were going to try and shut him down. And so he, you know, they're playing a very hardball game with each other, I think. And I think Bolton, my personal belief is he or one of his associates somehow, you know, leaked a manuscript of the book and wanted to get it out there, which would make it more difficult for the White House to do this. Now, as it turns out this week, the White House said they sent a warning that they were going to, you know, they were going to withhold the book on saying that it was classified top secret. And most people who know Bolton know that he's not stupid enough to have done that, that he knows enough about top secret clearance and top secret information that he would not have put that in the book under those circumstances. So there's going to be some kind of a battle royale between Bolton and the White House over this book. We'll see what happens. But in the meantime, of course, all this drops in the middle of the impeachment trial, where Bolton has been kind of the specter hanging over the whole thing from the very beginning. And Mitch McConnell's entire, you know, plan was to do everything he could to truncate this trial as much as possible, end it quickly before the State of the Union, and not have any witnesses, particularly not have John Bolton, which also indicates to me that McConnell knew about this book, what was in this book as well, even though
right.
he said he didn't, but I don't believe it. So the whole plan has been to keep Bolton out of this trial. And, you know, when this news came down and it said what it said, you know, suddenly it kind of shook the firmament a little bit among the Republicans. Now, whether that means it shook enough, I don't know. I mean, I doubt it. My personal belief is that, you know, that what will happen is there'll be three votes. to, you know, we're doing this a little early before we're broadcast, and you know, there will be three votes. But I really doubt that McConnell has lost hold of his caucus. So, you know, we'll see. It's doubtful.
But why do you think McConnell would say
that?
Why would McConnell say that?
To get the MAGAs to start, you know, harassing the Senate, the wavering Senate.
Right. So, but my point is that I think, like, McConnell, you know, as of whatever it was, Tuesday, when he says, "I don't have the votes," that means that there's a couple of waverers. And
sure,
he is trying to activate the base. But let's, you know, who would be susceptible to that, right? I mean, theoretically, Mitt Romney, and we are recording this before the vote, so, you know, we're guessing here. But Mitt Romney presumably is somewhat insulated from that because he's in Utah,
right,
and Trump isn't particularly popular. Lamar Alexander is retiring, and so he may, as a like a salve for, you know, Murkowski and for Collins, if they need it, may join. I guess the question is, like, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski has built, you know, her reputation on independence. And remember, we're just talking about voting to have a witness.
Right.
All right. Well, listen, we got to take a quick break. Let's come back. We'll continue this conversation. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We're talking to the great Digby. Sam Cedar here. Co-hosting Ring of Fire is the highlight of my week, but I got a day job too. Every weekday, I host the Majority Report, covering the news of the day and interviewing great progressive guests. And now it's super easy for you to tune in. We just released an app for your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. Go to MajorityApp.com to download, and you can listen live or to recorded versions of past shows, and it's totally free. That's MajorityApp.com. Download and listen for free.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Digby.
So, Heather, in the last segment, obviously, we're talking about impeachment. Specifically, we're talking about the question of witnesses. I mean, we will get to the arguments that that folks like Alan Dershowitz and Jay Sekulow were trying to make, and Ray as well. These are the attorneys of Donald Trump. But we were speculating when Mitch McConnell earlier in the week basically said, he didn't say it in so many words, but I need people to put pressure on your senators because I don't have the votes yet that I need to prevent witnesses from showing up. We were speculating, like, who might be those people who could feel the pressure. And it feels to me like it would be Susan Collins. I mean, it, you know, maybe there was others, but I don't know who else would be as susceptible to these pressures, or maybe Mitt Romney, if there's a perception that Mitt Romney wants to run for president, but I, you know, 5 years from now or something, which is conceivable, assuming, you know, he may presume that, like, there's going to be a Democratic president, and who knows what the calculations are here. But I agree with you. Mitch McConnell does not want any witnesses. And I'm, you know, we were talking about this manuscript where the White House basically said there's some national security problems there. I think they're also afraid of the push to have the manuscript be submitted as, like, you know, in lieu of testimony, because we all know it's going to happen, right? I mean, they could take it down to that secret vault that they have, and everybody looks at it, and no one's allowed to take notes, and everybody comes out, and everybody says it, right, says a different thing. But the book is going to come out eventually. John Bolton is going to talk eventually. And that's a concern. And it seems to me that if there's a dispute over the submitted testimony, then everybody's just going to be like, well, why don't you just have him show up and ask him the questions? And so they're in a jam. I mean, it seems we had the Des Moines Register this week come out and say that Grassley and Joni Ernst, in particular, she's up for re-election, they're not doing their job by having a legit process. And that's, I think, very problematic for them. Tom Tillis is losing to his primary opponent in Georgia. Doug Collins is going to jump in, which means that I can't remember her name now, but she was appointed interim senator. She's going to have to tack to the right. And the whole point of her her being appointed was so that she didn't have to attack to the right. I mean, the Republicans have some challenges in the Senate, it seems to me.
Absolutely. And that's what you and I have been talking about again for a long time, of what the real calculation of impeachment was. I mean, of course, the Democrats wanted to get this out on the record and make a stand against what Trump has done. I don't think there's any doubt that there was at least some level of sincerity in that. I mean, I know I feel it. And I think people in the party feel it as well. But it was also clear from the beginning that getting him removed would be a very, very long shot.
Impossible.
So, you know, what they were doing was trying to put this kind of heat on the Senate, recognizing that even if they win the presidency next fall, that without the Senate out of Mitch McConnell's hands, that it was just, you know, it's another 4 years of treading water at best. I mean, they'll do some things with the executive branch that would be very helpful, but to really do the kind of reforms that need to be done, Mitch McConnell cannot be in charge of the Senate. So, you know, I think that was a big part of the strategy here, was to get this into the Senate and then put the heat on these people. And, you know, John Bolton, of all people, is not someone I would have expected to do it. And I don't want to, you know, I don't want to indulge in any kind of glorification of John Bolton. I mean, he's a warmongering, you know, wingnut hawk. I mean, he's a very dangerous man who never should have been anywhere near the White House. Having said that, what's happened here, I think, I mean, people talk a lot about his motive being money, because he was paid, I think, $2 million in advance for this book, and he maybe stands to make several million on it. But give me a break. John Bolton could make several million dollars without writing this book after leaving the Trump administration, whether on good terms or bad, as a former national security advisor. I mean, they are handing out money by the barrel full in Trump world to anybody. I read Pam Bondi is making $135,000 a month working for the governor of Qatar on a part-time basis, even as she's working as the president's lawyer.
Right.
And you tell me John Bolton couldn't make this money. So I don't think it's money. I think it's ego. And I think what happened was that Bolton got in there for the first time in his career with some, you know, the chance of having real influence to, you know, do what he wanted to do. And he came crashing up against this, you know, weirdo, Donald Trump, who wouldn't listen to him. And even more than that, treated him very disrespectfully. And I think he does that to everybody, and he did it to him. And Bolton is, just, you know, he's not the first one. I mean, there's Tillerson, there's Mattis, there's all of them. He treated like garbage. But Bolton's the first one who is fighting back.
And I think Bolton was not in there to do what those other people were supposedly in there to do, which was to constrain him. Bolton was in there with a different agenda. And so I think his mentality towards it was very different. All right. We got a lot more to talk about in terms of impeachment, these dynamics when we return. And then, of course, we got to talk about 2020. There's a lot of stuff going on, folks. And we should probably mention the fact that the Trump administration rolled out a plan to give away a bunch of Palestinian land, and the Palestinians rejected it. We'll be back with more on Ring of Fire in a moment. Digby will join me in the next hour. I'm Sam Seder. Back in a moment. Just ahead, John Nichols reports from Iowa ahead of Monday's caucus. I'm Sam Seder. This, Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, folks, Sam Seder here. If you like Ring of Fire Radio, and if you like the Majority Report, have I got news for you. Every morning, we do a five-minute podcast. It's less than 5 minutes, in fact, and it gives you all the top headlines you're going to need to know throughout the day. It's called the AM Quickie. We deliver all this news, and we do it really quick, and we do it in the morning. That's how we came up with the title, AM Quickie. You can sign up at amquickie.com or wherever your podcasts are found. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. This Monday, the people of Iowa will caucus to discuss and vote on candidates running in the Democratic primary. Here to discuss, John Nichols from The Nation magazine. So, John, have you been in Iowa at all?
I have been to Iowa, my friend.
All right. Well, what's happening there?
We are balls, baby.
Well, I appreciate that. I think it's spelled differently, but I'll still take part ownership of that. We are now just, I don't know, almost, you could almost count it in hours until the Iowa caucus. You are a longtime observer of Iowa caucuses. Have you over the years been able to sort of gauge, to get a sense of what's actually going on the ground? Or is it too tricky?
No, I don't think it's too tricky, but you do have to be on the ground. The big danger with the Iowa caucuses is that people look at polls, or they kind of look from afar at, you know, what reports they get. And it does require you to physically be there, and I'll tell you why. The Iowa caucuses are small, not big. The actual turnout of eligible voters for the Iowa caucuses is a relatively tiny portion of the overall electorate there. And so as a result, going to rallies, going to events, going to forums there gives you a really good measure of things because, you know, if 1,000 people show up in Storm Lake or 500 show up in Cedar Rapids, that's a measurable portion of the people that will go to the caucuses in that place. And so you want to go out and see who's got the energy. You want to look at the grassroots efforts there, which are by and large far more important than the TV advertising. But yeah, I don't want to get into too much detail here, but yeah, you can get a flavor of it. And you know what the number one question you ask people of, you know, really, especially people backing some of the lesser known candidates, it's who's your second choice?
Right.
Because in the caucuses, if you come in for a candidate and they don't get 15% support, you're going to end up caucusing for somebody other than the person whose campaign pin you're wearing. And so once you know a few of those dynamics, you can cover them and, you know, get at least some feel.
Give us a sense of what your feel is. I mean, does it end up dovetailing with what you're seeing in terms of polling? Is it because of that dynamic, do polls really tell the full story? Tease this out for us. It's so much more, it seems, complicated than obviously just a primary, right? People go and they vote.
It's
they
very
vote through
different.
Their.
Yeah.
So, all right. So, give us a sense of if your experience on the ground there this time around seems to coincide with the polling.
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think it basically does coincide with the polls, but the polls are sort of a starting point for hopefully a deeper analysis. The polls right now show, by and large, not all of them, but overall, show a Bernie Sanders surge, and it's quite significant. If you kind of look at the quality polls, the polls that interview a lot of people, seem to have a good reputation on the ground, you know, in the fall, they showed, at a certain point, they showed Elizabeth Warren really rising, Biden kind of holding strength. Then you had a Buttigieg surge. There's no question of that, and he went way up at a certain point. But since the start of the year, since about the first week or so in the year, you have seen a steady pattern of increase for Bernie Sanders in the polling. The Des Moines Register poll had him a little bit ahead. Now we've seen New York Times and Emerson polls that put him way ahead. And I think that's credible from what I see on the ground. When I've been out there, and I was just out there over the weekend, when I'm at events, it's just amazing. The Sanders events are huge. They have incredibly high energy. They do have a lot of people who look like traditional Iowa caucus goers, but they have a heck of a lot of people who don't look like traditional Iowa caucus goers, younger folks and you know, just a diversity of folks that kind of expands it out. And so I always look at that as a baseline. But then the interesting thing is that when you go to the Sanders events, once the event is done, if you linger around for 15 minutes, you will see a huge portion of the people who were at the event, who came for the theater, if you will, for, Michael Moore speaking, for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for the band Portugal the Man playing, and then for Sanders himself speaking. If you stick around after, what's fascinating is you see a lot of people, hundreds of people, doing training to go caucus and to go to the doors. So they're not just having events. They're actually structurally doing the sort of organizing you need to do. So my sense is Sanders has the lead that the polls is showing is credible and real at this point. And then the one other thing I would throw into the mix is that I think that Buttigieg, who has done well in the polls in Iowa and continues to poll at a reasonably strong point, he also has something going on. When I've seen his events, there's clearly, you know, there's good crowds there. When you talk to the people, Buttigieg seems to be attracting a lot of traditional Iowa caucus goers, i.e. the people who go every 4 years no matter what. A lot of them seem to like him. And so my sense is that he also is someone who's in a position to finish pretty well.
That's interesting. And so if I understand what you're saying, and I've read something to this effect, that Sanders basically bootstrapped these rallies and was sort of has an apparatus that is taking advantage of the live events, I guess, to sort of exponentially grow his organization. Is there any indication that other campaigns are doing something exactly like that, similar to that?
Yeah, they're all trying to do that, Sam. And it's just a matter of how many people you sort of have enthusiastically sticking around doing it. Look, the Biden campaign clearly wants to do that, but the Biden events tend to be smaller. I think you have a little less of that. But even I will tell you, there was a Biden event, you know, a week or so ago, a couple weeks now, I guess, where former Secretary of State John Kerry was literally sitting with people, getting them to sign their caucus cards, i.e. to, you know, commit to caucus and check on their location and that. So all the campaigns do this. I'm just saying that it looks to me like the Sanders campaign is far more systematic. And that it goes sort of deeper with it. They are getting the people to commit to caucus, but they are also working very, very hard on getting the people to talk to their neighbors, to draw neighbors. You know, don't just go to the caucus alone, go with a carload of people. And that sort of thing historically is very valuable. The other thing that the Sanders people are doing that's interesting is they are extremely generous and extremely kind to supporters of Andrew Yang and the small group of people who are supporters of Tom Steyer and supporters of people who are sympathetic to Elizabeth Warren and others. They clearly understand that at the caucus, when you're in that room, because each candidate is trying to maximize their level of support, you got to have 15% of the people in the room to begin to get your support registered for the purposes of ultimately getting delegates. And they're clearly looking very, very hard and very, very, in a very sophisticated way, I think, at how to get as many of those other people in the room over to their corner. And on caucus night, that can really exponentially improve your position.
All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about the recent endorsement that Warren got, and I want to get more of a sense of the race. And I'm going to force you to do a little prognostication, not necessarily as to who's going to win in Iowa, but the different scenarios that we could see coming out of Iowa, going into New Hampshire. Things are going to start happening if people can believe it, at an even more rapid pace, I should say. We'll be right back. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Be right back with the great John Nichols after this.
I've always done the best I can.
Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking to The Nation magazine's John Nichols about the upcoming Iowa caucus. So, John, in the last segment, you were giving us a sense of both sort of what you have experienced over the years in reporting on what's going on in Iowa, and specifically on how the campaigns are taking advantage and have been taking advantage since, probably 6 to 12 months they've been doing this, holding rallies, using those as a mechanism in which to build a volunteer force. You told us that Sanders seems to have an operation that is the most well-oiled in this regard and optimizing it the most. And to a large extent, right, this is more than the other campaigns. All campaigns have a ground game, but it seems that the theory of the case for the Sanders campaign is that they are going to bring low propensity voters, low propensity caucusers, I guess, in this instance, into the mix in a way that other campaigns don't look to do in the same way. And that this is really going to be not only the formula for them winning Iowa, but their formula for them winning the primary and, to a certain extent, their governing formula as well. What's your sense about that? I mean, do we have, can we tell at this point, like, X percentage of Sanders caucus goers maybe doing it for the first time?
No, we don't know that. We won't know till caucus night. But on caucus night, you will, because there's a lot of, frankly, there's a weird kind of exit polling on caucuses where you do ask people if it's their first caucus, stuff like that. It's not as sophisticated as you might want to get, but you can get a good feel. You'll also, frankly, get a good feel going into the room. Remember, you can be in the room where a caucus occurs. And if there's a lot of 21-year-olds there, these are people who haven't caucused before. And so I think there, you're going to see a lot of that. The other thing, though, that I would put in the mix is I do think, all this structural stuff, all this strategic grassroots stuff is vital. There's another element of it, and I know we're going to talk about some endorsements in a second, but I'll throw one other thing on that I think has benefited Sanders, and I wrote about it for The Nation this week. He came out really strongly against war with Iran. In fact, I would go so far as to say he took a pretty militant stance, along with Ro Khanna, saying, no funds for a war with Iran, no support for it. We just don't want it. Now, to some extent, that tension has dialed down as regards Iran. We know that. But in Iowa, which is a state that has, especially in the Democratic Party there, a really strong anti-war base, I think that solidified and shored up a substantial amount of his support from older folks and from more traditional caucus goers. And so I think he's got this combination of a very strong organization and, frankly, a message that, while not uniquely powerful in Iowa, has a particular resonance there. And when I was interviewing people out there, I was surprised by how many, when I said, why are you back in Sanders, brought up war and peace issues first.
That's fascinating. Because I think that is, that's clearly Sanders. The people can argue about the specifics of the proposals of legislation on Medicare for All between Warren and Sanders. Yeah. And I think there's some difference there without a doubt. But the most substantial and the sort of almost like the prima facie difference between Bernie Sanders and the rest of the field is in foreign policy. And you and I are people who I think you know, generally feel that foreign policy, you know, just by observation, foreign policy is usually not at the forefront at a time where we're not involved in a war, or at least, you know, a massive war. We've got these forever wars that are going on, but they're low grade. People walking around don't even talk about them, you know, in any. But I wonder if Donald Trump, in his facing the world and the sort of raising the specter of World War III at any time, because he's like, why can't we just nuke them? Or we, you know, we're going to nuke Iran or whatever it is. I wonder if that has heightened the sensitivities, at the very least, of the Democratic voters.
I think it has. And again, I just, you know, I had a sense of this. Congressman Ro Khanna, who I've interviewed many times, had said to me he felt it in Iowa. He felt like in the second week of January, after Sanders had come out very militantly against going to war and really incorporated into his speeches, Ro Khanna told me that when he was going to events, people, that was like people were just bringing it up on a regular basis. So when I went out there this last weekend, I asked a lot of folks, you know, I just said, what's, you know, kind of what's driving you? What's in your heart? You know, what's kind of the thing that's really, and like the first person I asked was a county supervisor in Blackhawk County, Iowa. That's the Waterloo area. And he said, oh, this whole war thing, you know what I mean? And he was very passionate about it. Now, he's a Sanders backer, no doubt about it. But I just want to emphasize, I think this is an undercovered part of the dynamic. And again, Iowa has a long history of rewarding candidates who have the more anti-war stance. It doesn't mean they always win. But just remember that in 2007, when he went out to Iowa as, you know, kind of an upstart candidate, Barack Obama, in every speech, or at least in a lot of his speeches, made a real point of saying, you know, he had opposed the war in Iraq. And it was one of the things that distinguished him from Hillary Clinton back then. And I met a lot of people in 2008 who said they were caucusing for Obama because of that. So I do think Sanders has got a little something going there.
Interesting. All right. Well, we got about a minute and a half left. Not as much as I wanted, but this has been fascinating. So just tell me, what do you think the implications are of the endorsement that Elizabeth Warren got? I just noticed today the New York Times, even amongst their own readers, the New York Times endorsement doesn't seem to hold that much weight. Maybe it was because they endorsed two people. Not the case with the Iowa Register. What are the implications of that?
Well, that's exactly the right question. Look, the New York Times endorsement was an incredibly poorly thought, badly done endorsement. You don't endorse two people at a point where folks are trying to sort it out. And frankly, there was conflicting messages in it. I just don't think it was effective. The Des Moines Register was the opposite. The Des Moines Register, which had interviewed all these candidates, came out very, very strongly for Warren, and they made a really smart argument. Their argument was, she's not radical. There's nothing extreme about what she's saying. She is proposing the right solutions for this time. And remember, this is the Des Moines Register, which is not as enthusiastic about Sanders. They argued she's somebody who has more of a skill with governance, right? And so they make this argument for her that was, you know, I guess for lack of a better term, a very sort of FDR argument, you know, that she's a little bit, you know, in this tradition of somebody who, if they get elected, actually will know how to do some great big things with government. Now, you can disagree with that. I disagreed with some elements of their editorial. That's not my point. My point is it was effectively argued and very, very good at it. Obviously, the Warren people are going to use it a lot, but I also think that Warren should take it to heart. I mean, I think they've in many ways framed out a good argument for her. And what's going to be interesting is I think at this point, a lot of the Sanders people are locked in. So Warren's challenge is to draw people away from Buttigieg and from Klobuchar and from, you know, some of these other folks. And that editorial, I think the Iowa, Des Moines Register folks are very savvy. I think they wrote that editorial with that in mind.
Interesting.
It may well help Elizabeth Warren.
Well, I guess we will find out in a couple of days. John Nichols from The Nation Magazine, always a pleasure.
Pleasure, my friend.
John Nichols is the national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine. He is host of Next Left, The Nation's podcast featuring interviews with rising progressive politicians who explain how they plan to change our country for the better.
When we come back, Heather Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com. Support the show.